Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and this week's show is the last edition for a few weeks. I am taking a couple of weeks off, so our next weekly show will be published on June 30, just so you all know. But yeah, what a great bunch of news to talk about this week before we go on break. Outstanding, really, and we'll get into all of that in a minute. This week's show is brought to you by Datadog what they'd call it. And Michael Yamnitsky will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about cloud security posture management. Datadog has launched a product in that space. It's in beta, but anyway, we'll be hearing about the types of issues CSPM products can help to unearth in that interview with Michael coming up later. That is this week's sponsor interview coming up after this week's news, which starts now. And Adam, of course, we've got two absolutely fantastic news items to talk about this week. The seizure of the Colonial ransomware payment by the FBI and whoever. And we also have the fantastic story about the Anom encrypted, telephone network stuff that was a caper by the AFP and FBI. But let's start off with the Colonial news. It looks like there may have been a little bit of hound release here.
Yes, reporting says that the FBI has somehow recovered an amount of bitcoins that matches quite closely to the amount paid by Colonial in their ransom. It showed up in a bitcoin wallet that they had the key for, and now they've seized it.
I mean, it sounds like magic, right? Like all of that bitcoin just showed up in a wallet that the FBI happened to have the private key for. That's weird. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like, Moxie strolling down the street and tripping over a fully specced out Cellebrite box. Yeah, same thing. FBI's, strolling across the tubes and, wouldn't you know it, someone's dropped their wallet.
There's been some really dumb takes on this. Like, people are on Twitter wondering if this is because NSA has a supercomputer in the basement, you know what I mean, that cracked the wallet. It's like, no, man, that's not how this works. I mean, my working theory is, and if you look at the affidavit, they actually spell out all of the transactions that led to that Bitcoin winding up in that wallet, but there was a big transfer from like 14 addresses to this single address on May 27, and that's the one that has US military or intelligence agency written all over it, basically.
Yeah, the FBI hasn't really confirmed, how they came across it. What they said was kind of, we don't really want to talk about exactly how it happened because we don't want to give away our techniques, but yeah, I mean, the fact that the money just kind of showed up, I mean, certainly one of the options is that someone, some spooky cybery type strolled in and kind of, helped themselves, which, given that they seem to be able to pull the thread on the particular dark side affiliate responsible for Colonial pretty quickly, OPSEC perhaps wasn't really their forte in the first place. I guess this is what happens when, as you say, some hounds get released.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's pretty much an open secret at this point that the affiliate is basically a teenager. Right? Like, this is something that I've heard from a few people. The Russians know who it is. The Americans know who it is. Half of the bloody industry knows who it is. And yeah, if I had to guess, they got some shell popped on them and, that's how they lost their Bitcoin. But it's an interesting way to do it, right? Where you get one arm of the government to steal the Bitcoin and then stash it somewhere where the FBI just does a forfeiture, lodges the forfeiture paperwork and it's got a bow on it,
Yeah. I mean, some of the reporting made a bit of a thing about, it was located physically in Northern California and so they were able to go get a warrant and... Like that bit of the story.
Yeah, you're coming in halfway through the movie at that point, right?
Exactly. But there was a lot of people saying, I can't believe, Russian hackers have their infrastructure. And it's like, no, I don't know that they do have their infrastructure in Northern California conveniently within the jurisdiction. No, that's probably not what happened.
Yeah, you skipped a step, basically. But, we don't have this confirmed or anything, but that's our working theory. I mean, that's my working theory, basically, is that this was an agency that was not the FBI helpfully moving those bitcoins into a wallet that was accessible to the FBI. So, meanwhile, in other news, we've got a report here from Reuters, but plenty of outlets covered it. The United States is going to treat ransomware as a similar priority to terrorism. Now, this got misconstrued by a bunch of people as they're going to use the same tactics against ransomware crews as terrorists, which is really not what they've said here. But it looks like DOJ is going to treat this stuff extremely seriously. Things are starting to move here.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of people's takes on, you know, on InfoSec Twitter was that we were going to start seeing, you know, drone strikes on hacker flats or whatever, which, yeah, isn't what they've said. This is
and to
really
be clear,
about...
to be clear, when we talk about warheads on foreheads, we're joking.
Oh, dear. But, yeah, so what they're talking about really is, you know, a bunch of things that they have done to deal with terrorism, like centralized reporting and centralized kind of oversight of investigations and really trying to get visibility of all of the things that are being reported, all the investigations that are happening, you know, around the country in different parts of the government in the US, and really have a nationally coherent strategy and set of data and set of goals to address what they see as a quite a real threat to them. And, you know, hopefully we don't see it turning into the war on drugs or the war on terror, but, you know, there is certainly some parallels, I guess, in, you know, the way that they want to start thinking about this as a coherent problem rather than a bunch of, you know, smaller, unrelated, distributed things.
Well, I just remembering something I said, I think, last year, which is the war on ransomware will be a lot fucking quicker. I mean, this is why not pick the one that we can win, you know? Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I mean, fair enough, right? Yes.
What else have we got here? Yeah, so look, I had Tim Watts, an Australian MP, on the show a couple of weeks back, and he said that he expected this to be a G7 agenda item. It looks like that is actually happening now. This will be discussed at G7, and everyone's going to get together and come up with a action plan. That's according to the US National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. And meanwhile, Putin is just outraged. He's outraged that people are trying to smear him with links to ransomware, and it's just, you know, it's appalling. Poor guy.
Yeah, no, he's certainly, you know, one doth protest a little bit too much there, perhaps. But yes, he says, you know, this is going to provoke conflicts and that, you know, it totally wasn't Russia and they had nothing to do with it. And even Biden said that he had nothing to do with it. So
why are you protesting? Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one, right? Like, so I got the quote here, a translation, which is, I have heard about some meat processing company. It's nonsense. We understand. It's just laughable. A pipeline? It's nonsense too, Putin called a Russian news station, right? So it's, yeah, how dare you? JBS, though, it looks like they've actually managed to weather this. That's the meat processing company, of course, global meat processing company based out of Brazil, but with substantial operations in the United States and here in Australia. It looks like they're actually managing to muddle their way through this, according to this reporting from the Washington Post.
Yeah, which I guess is kind of positive in a way, like seeing a really big organization, you know, kind of go through this in a relatively, you know, it sounds like they had some plans, but they've said, you know, we've had plans for doing this, we're currently executing those plans, we had backups, you know, things are coming back online, processing's coming back online kind of gradually. But yeah, I mean, compared to how much of a disaster this has been for some other organizations, it seems like maybe they had, had their stuff together, which...
Well, I mean, we were really skeptical when they were talking about their timeline for getting things going again. And yeah, it looks like they had a good plan and it was well executed. Meanwhile, and this isn't in the news list, but Colonial, I think their CEO did some testimony before government just over the last week and was saying, yeah, we totally didn't have a plan. Whoops, my bad, you know.
Which, I mean, that's a timely reminder for listeners that, you know, there is a difference between not having a plan and having to deal with stuff and having a plan and having to deal with the stuff. And it seems like a lot of people are going to have to deal, right? And we've seen the, you know, the never-ending list of stories we have to cover in the news about people getting ransomware. And yeah, it's worth having a plan and it's worth exercising that plan before you need it.
Adam Janofsky at The Record reports that the strain of ransomware that affected JBS was actually Reval. So that's an interesting little fact there. That's according to the FBI.
Well, it's good to have some attribution. That's exactly who it was. That particular crew, they've been consistent and operating for a long time and making a lot of cash by the look of it. But yeah, they haven't traditionally been the really like flashy crew. I think maybe they bit off a bit more than they could chew with the size and scale of JBS. And obviously, right after the Colonial thing, you know, they got a lot of attention that perhaps they weren't really anticipating.
I should point out too, just on that Bitcoin seizure, it looks like the Bitcoin they got back was the Bitcoin for the affiliate, not actually DarkSide's Bitcoin, right? So that's something to keep in mind. This was a seizure just from the person who actually ran that particular campaign. As far as we know, DarkSide's Bitcoin is fine, but I don't expect it to stay that way for very long. Yeah. A couple of TV stations in the United States have been ransomware to the point that they are down. And we've got some excellent reporting from Kevin Collier over at NBC on this one. And he even got some of these stations on record, which was an achievement.
Yeah, we've seen what reports of a number of, you know, local affiliates of the big network stations in Florida, North Carolina, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, all off air. They're part of the same group of companies. And yeah, they're at the point where they can't actually schedule their broadcasts. And yeah, that's a, I mean, you know, of all of the American things that we've seen, you know, being hit, you know, oil and gas, meat, and now TV. I mean, that's quite of a list. You know, I guess at least it's not nationwide, because then they'd be up in arms. But yeah, I mean, they're going after the American way of life, man. They're hot dogs.
They are. That's, yeah, the Cox Media Group is the company there. We did see, you know, we saw that big ransomware attack against the Nine Network here in Australia. Apparently, like, that dragged out for ages. I mean, for all I know, that's still, they're still recovering from that. It was an absolute disaster. And what else have we got? Oh, the Massachusetts ferries. So many people have mentioned this one to me. They're like, not the ferry. Come on.
Yes, so ransomware has hit the operators of ferries operating Massachusetts. If you'd like to take a ferry to Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket, which, you know, there's quite a lot of fancy holiday houses there. Although I imagine the sort of people that have holiday houses there.
They probably have their own helicopter. Boats, yeah.
Yeah, or boats or helicopters or whatever else. But yes, if you'd like to buy a ticket on a ferry, you're currently out of luck.
Boo. Fujifilm has had to close a bunch of stuff down. You know, we're just whizzing through the ransomware roundup at this point, but Fujifilm is another big brand impacted this week.
Yeah, Fuji said they've got themselves ransomware. They're currently in the process of recovering it. They claim they're not going to pay it, and they are going to recover from backups. Fuji does make a bunch of stuff in the medical industry. You know, they're not just, you know, film, camera, photography is a bit out of fashion these days, but they are still a really big organization with a bunch of, you know, pretty important products, you know, in medical imaging and that kind of thing. So always concerning to see it, you know, in the supply chain of medical stuff.
Yeah, now this one I think is really funny, because this is just another example of ransomware actors targeting the wrong things. They have gone after a DC-based platform called iConstituent, which is used by politicians. I mean, what a brilliant idea, you know, because those people aren't going to cause you problems at all.
I mean, you know, I know the ransomware scene doesn't operate as a cohesive whole, but, you know, if you were sitting down as, you know, council of Russian crooks and you wanted to decide on your targeting for the week, maybe hitting, you know, the systems that US politicians use to communicate with their constituents, you know, right after all the other things that happened, probably not the best idea you've ever had. But hey, this is what you get when you distribute these decisions out, you know, to teenage affiliates.
Yes, that is maybe a bit of a weakness in the strategic part of your plan.
Yes.
We also have some reporting from Sean Lingus at CyberScoop about a hospital in Massachusetts that actually paid a ransom, but that was some time ago, and they're just sort of doing the disclosure now.
Yeah, this was a 126-bed hospital in Attleboro, Massachusetts, that paid the ransom to stop all the medical data and other patient information that had been taken from being leaked. They've now come out and reported that to the regulator in Massachusetts. And I guess, you know, if we're going to see, you know, a more centralized approach to collecting all the information about this, then, yeah, we will probably start to see a lot more, you know, disclosure of exactly what's been happening with people who have or haven't been paying when they get ransomed.
Now, we got an interesting one here from Andy Greenberg over at Wired. It appears that some sort of pipeline-related company, I think they're sort of somewhere in the pipeline supply chain, they apparently got owned and like 70 gig worth of their data got stolen, and now DDoS Secrets has their hands on it, and they're like selectively leaking parts of it. Can you walk us through this one?
So the story goes, this company, Linestar Integrity Services, that makes a bunch of equipment that's used in oil and gas pipelines, got themselves ransom, 70 gig of data nicked, and then it's attributed to a crew called Ching Team, which kind of style themselves as a Chinese ransomware crew, but there's no real, you know, attribution beyond their own choice of name. How the data got out of their kind of leak site to DDoS Secrets is a little bit murky.
Well, I think they snagged it off the dark web. That's maybe what happened here.
There's been a bunch of suggestion that, you know, if you're in the supply chain and you can leverage their relationship with customers, that this is a good avenue to then go and attack downstream, you know, into the wider oil and gas industry, which is a thing that we certainly see done in, you know, nation state attackers. But yeah, as we kind of mentioned earlier, like, ransomware has, I guess, a bit less of a strategic focus. So I'm not sure whether that angle totally rang true for me in the reporting.
Another win for law enforcement, and the United States has managed to arrest a Latvian woman, age 55, Ala Witty, who apparently was a developer of the, well, one of the developers of the TrickBot malware.
Exactly what she was doing in Miami, Florida, I'm not quite sure, but she was arrested February 6th in Miami,
probably on
Florida.
Her way to Disney World in Orlando, Florida. you know, because that's why do they do this anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like if you are an Eastern European malware developer, maybe going to Disney World in Florida isn't the best plan that you've ever had, and maybe you should do something else
instead.
They
don't know who I am. I'll be fine. Yeah, no, you won't. No, you won't.
No, you won't. But yeah, and apparently, she's been working on TrickBot for quite some time and was not particularly opsec-y about it. Like, even published, versions of the TrickBot Trojan on like her own dev site and stuff. So yeah, not real.
This is the portfolio. You know, here's my portfolio. I've contributed to the TrickBot project. Sensational uptake, very profitable, etc.
Exactly right, which, yeah, doesn't seem the best thought through plan that I've ever heard, but hey, you know, probably made more money than I did. So.
Yeah, well, maybe not. You know, it really depends where you are, I think, in the pecking order, right? But
yeah, that's true.
Anyway, Alawiti, 55, of Latvia, enjoy prison, because that's where you're going. Mm-hmm. Now, we spoke about this Fujitsu-like web collaboration platform last week that got owned pretty hard to the point where Fujitsu actually took it down. It looks like, according to this report at least, another one by Sean Lingus at Cyberscoop, it looks like this one has affected the Tokyo Olympics.
Yes, apparently the Olympic organizers there had some manner of like cybersecurity drill, which obviously it's, you know, if you're an Olympic organizer, given the history of hacking the Olympics over the last few rounds of that, you know, it's important that you understand drill and exercise. Apparently they were using this platform to coordinate the cybersecurity drills for Olympics organizers, which is a little bit awkward when that platform itself got owned.
Yes. I mean, but name a good collaboration platform that's not going to get owned, right? Like it's kind of hard.
I mean, it's hard to make anything that doesn't get owned these days. Oh, dear.
Now, look, we've been waiting a long time for the Supreme Court in the United States to make a decision in a sort of key case regarding the CFAA. And that decision's come down, and it's come down on the side that most people listening to this podcast will be happy about, right? So this is Van Buren versus the United States, and it involves this CFAA thing where if you do something that is more than you're technically authorized to do on a computer, like, is that a criminal offense? Supreme Court has said under the CFAA, no, it's not, right? So this is about exceeding authorized access. So if you do, like if you're a cop, and I think that was the case here, if you're a cop and you search through the license plate database or whatever, in a way that you're not really authorized to do in your job, in a normal course of your duties. Previously, it was understood that was actually a crime under the CFAA, and now, according to the Supreme Court, it is not. This will have some knock-on effects to other, you know, similar types of scenarios, I would imagine, but I'm not going to sit here and confidently talk about the downstream effects until we've seen some decent legal analysis of this.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it has been quite a long time coming, and we've seen a few cases where, you know, this has gone and kind of come up with results that are not particularly equitable or in line with what you'd expect for the law, you know, where it just automatically becomes a computer crime or is a computer crime, even when it's about something else and computers were just kind of involved tangentially. I mean, you know, I guess that's a reflection of the role that computers have now taken as part of everything, as opposed to in the old days when it, you know, doing computer hacking was just computer hacking and it was kind of separate from, a lot of other mainstream parts of society. And yeah, this is a change that I think probably is a good thing, because it provides a bit more flexibility in how they prosecute them. And, you know, in this case with the cop, you know, clearly he did something wrong, clearly he should be punished, but whether that was a computer crime, I think, you know, this judgment now decides it wasn't. So that's, that seems the sensible outcome to me.
Yeah, I mean, we're not, you know, the guy sounds like a bit of a dirtbag, but, it doesn't make him a computer criminal, right? And I think
exactly
that's what
right.
this is all about.
Exactly. Regular criminal, not a computer criminal.
Yeah, exactly. Just a regular dirtbag. So now we get to talk about, look, you know, obviously my favorite story this week.
Yes.
Criminals, man. Anom. Like, this is just such an amazing story. So the story goes, and look, the details are still a little bit sketchy, right? The story goes, a few years ago, I'm piecing this together from multiple reports, some drug importer in San Diego became an FBI informant. I don't know why. I don't know if that's because they got caught doing something. I have no idea why. But they'd apparently dumped a bunch of money into developing an app. It was pre-launch phase, but they developed like a EncroChat style, you know, Sky ECC style encrypted app and phone combo. And they basically said to the FBI, well, you know, I can help you run this thing. There were apparently some beers involved between some Australian Federal Police people and some FBI people, and they cooked up a plan to run, basically, to run like an EncroChat-style platform or like a Phantom Secure-style platform themselves, right? So they were going to operate the whole thing, and they did it for years. And here in Australia, right, the AFP... Look, it's beautiful, like cherry on top, is they used this guy who's been a target of theirs for a long time. They basically tricked him into becoming like a influencer advocate for this technology. So he spread it to all his mates. Slow burn initially, they seeded the criminal underworld with like 50 devices. By the time they wrapped it up this week, they were 11,000 users of this thing. Now they're paying customers using dedicated hardware, right? And every single message was being intercepted by law enforcement. They dropped the hammer this week. And I saw the website too, before they put up the domain seized thing, even though they didn't really need to seize the domain because it was theirs. But, you know, really slick graphics and stuff. And there's a place where you could enter your invite code. So they really did this wonderful business, which was, you know, socially driven, where you needed an invite code from one of your criminal buddies to get it, right? They dropped the hammer this week. I mean, in Australia alone, we've seen 220 arrests. And we're talking Comanchero bikies. We're talking triads. We're talking about how they used intelligence to disrupt a... automatic weapons attack on a cafe here in Australia. Like, just real bad people. I would note too that about a week ago, I was just reading the local news. Some guy was just driving up the highway, got pulled over for speeding. This is a 24-year-old guy from Pottsville, New South Wales, got pulled over for speeding, and they searched his car and found 7 kilos of coke. And I remember reading that story last week, and I'm like, they knew the coke was in the car and the speeding was obviously just a, you know, whatever. And now this happens. Like, this is, we're seeing law enforcement describe this as 20 years of law enforcement in 2 months, like in terms of the takedown phase. It's just extraordinary. And of course, arrests in New Zealand as well and in the United States, I think. But it seems like, even though this was a joint FBI-AFP thing, it seems like it was really the Aussies who managed to get this device out there to the right people and really make the most of it. But what a sensational and simultaneously hilarious story.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a beautiful example of what, you know, modern supply chain looks like. You know, if you're having to make decisions about how you trust cloud applications or cloud services or, you know, even hardware, this is what having a real adversary looks like. And much as this is hilarious and wonderful and, you know, obviously has taken down, you know, a bunch of real bad people, prevented a bunch of people getting murdered, you know, you also got to look at it as a, like this is the thing we actually have to worry about for all of us in a way, because... real adversaries can do this kind of thing, and making trust choices, you know, and I'm not saying that you know, Australian biker gangs have great risk management practice. You know, I don't know how sophisticated their, you know, IT risk assessment for cloud services are, you know, whether you have to go and get everyone SOC 2 certified or whatever. But yeah, it's a really interesting study of what, you know, real pragmatic policing, pragmatic use of supply chain attacks for real-world purposes looks like.
I mean, supply chain is kind of like, that's one way to put it, but I think what they did here that was really clever was they kind of infiltrated the distribution chain. So yes, all of the people who'd been pushing stuff like EncroChat, when that went away, they needed a new product to make money. And so, bang, here was this wonderful new tool, Anom, you know, with it, that they could use to maintain their businesses. All of a sudden, they had a product to distribute again. It's a little bit like, I think the tactics they've used here, it's a lot like Silk Road 2, right?
Yes, yeah.
So they close Silk Road. Everyone flocks over to Silk Road 2, which is run basically by an informant, and everyone gets busted. It's dark web tactics 101, but applied to the meat space. And I'm 100% for this.
Yes. I mean, this is just, you know, it's a really smart and, you know, just pragmatic, accepting of the real world that they operate in and making it work for them the best they can approach to this. And as you say, it's worked well in the dark web. And I mean, even though, I mean, 11,000 devices is a significant, you know, fleet of things they could intercept. But of course, you know, the worldwide pool of criminals is much, much larger. But even the effects that this has on trust in that community, like being able to interact and do business, because we've seen how important it is in the Russian ransomware scene, like, to be able to transact business and trust each other and have, you know, forums with, you know, mediation processes and escrow systems and whatever else. Like, all of this social glue is disrupted by this, right? It's not just the individual people.
Well, secure communications are an accelerator for crime, right? Because free to talk and conspire and whatever, you know, if every time you want to have a illicit conversation, you need to paddle out into the surf with your associates so that you're pretty sure you're not being monitored, you know, that's going to gum up the works, right? So it's interesting. And it's clear that they will not be able to trust similar platforms again. Like, you know, this has happened like 3 or 4 times. This is the first time that law enforcement have actually launched the bloody thing, which is, you know, great. But you wouldn't trust a similar device in the future. And it's pretty clear that serious organized criminals don't trust commodity hardware because people like Mark Dowd exist, basically. And, you know, they actually rise to the level of being worth it. So, yeah, I mean, if you're a criminal at this point, operating at that sort of level, you really got to wonder, what do you do?
Yes. I mean, it's a very, very difficult place for them to be. And we've seen, I guess, you know, a bunch of criminal organizations attempt to, you know, for example, that was that cartel in Mexico that was running their own mobile network.
Yep.
But, you know, it ends up falling apart because the amount of people that you need to involve in your conspiracy gets too big and someone's going to snitch and, you know, the incentives don't line up for you to be able to have a safe place to communicate and organize.
But this sort of approach won't work against the cartels because they literally have CISOs and, you know, people like you working for them to make sure stuff like this does not happen.
Yes, but if modern risk management was going to work, I mean, maybe it does. Maybe it does work. I don't know.
Well, and the other issue, because I have heard people say, oh, you know, why didn't they run this for 10 years and snag the cartels? And it's like, well, quite often authorities know who these cartel people are, but you can't arrest them because they're surrounded by 4,000 people with machine guns at all times in the, you know, in the hinterland. So, you know, a different problem set, people. But look, I mean, it's just been incredible watching this news roll out. I was just watching the news this morning before we recorded this, and there was the ABC Adelaide guy sitting there on camera saying that the courtroom door should have been, you know, basically a revolving door over the last 24 hours as the number of people they brought into charge, you know, just grew and grew and grew. It's just been an extraordinary action. And, you know, it's funny, right? Like, let's be honest. Like, you know, there was the invite code thing. I screen capped it before they took it down. And I'm like, you know, what was the invite code? Dumbass? Ha ha ha. You know?
Dear. Yeah.
These bikers, right? Like the Comancheros in particular are in all sorts of trouble. The biker gangs here in Australia, they're violent. They push a lot of crystal meth. They are serious organized crime here. Police are saying now, because we do wastewater detection of drug use just as a survey tactic here in Australia, and they're saying that they will be able to detect a national drop in crystal meth consumption based just on these arrests.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, that really makes it quite real. Like that this is...
Tons of drugs. Like literally tons of drugs seized, hundreds of people arrested. Like this will be a movie.
Yeah, you're probably right. It probably will be. I don't know who's going to play the, you know, criminal underground influencer on Instagram pushing the...
Well, that's a guy named Hakan Ayik, who was recently the subject of some reporting from the Nine Network. And I mean, very recently, just before all this happened, there was a bunch of reporting on him going into details of his movements and stuff and his new life in Turkey. And then the cops dropped the hammer and out him as the idiot who introduced everyone to this stuff. They did that deliberately, right? They're telling him he needs to turn himself in before everybody kills him. So it's the cherry on top. That's what I mean about that being the cherry on top. Like they have utterly, utterly... done this guy over. Awesome.
They certainly have, and you know, you know, I don't want to say that's what you get for being an influencer, but
well, I mean, the irony there, Adam, is the irony there. You're aware that you're on a podcast. Anyway, so look, we'll move on from that story now. But I mean, look, there's still some unanswered questions. On the US side, like how did they get around, you know, Fourth Amendment issues, things like that? What were the legal authorizations involved here? It's all a bit complicated, but I imagine we're going to be talking about this one for quite some time. But let's move on to the next story. And we've got another one here from Australia. The geniuses at the Australian Defence Force invested billions of dollars into an Israeli battle management system. And that turns out it might have been a bit of a mistake.
Yes. For some years, Australia's been involved in building out this battle management system, you know, for managing all sorts of aspects, you know, of their military on the ground doing battle. They bought it from an Israeli contractor, which, I mean, obviously the Israelis are good at a lot of this stuff. So that's one on the plus side of the column. But yeah, on the other hand, you know, sourcing your military supply chain from other countries comes with a whole bunch of risks and considerations that are just really, really, really hard to solve. And at some point this has twigged, and we've seen reports that, you know, bits of the system are being, you know, either pulled out or turned off or temporarily disabled whilst they try and make sense of it. Apparently Britain has also been looking at deploying the same system. So there's certainly some
Well, now
concern.
They're asking us, like, what have you found? Like, nervously, you know, like this is the vibe at the moment. This is turning into a thing.
I mean, the British have been, you know, confident that they can make Huawei safe to use in their mobile network. Well, they were anyway. So maybe they could do the same work here. But yeah, this is, you know, it's an awkward position to be in, and a real reminder of, you know, we don't say balkanization anymore, but I mean, the way that the software supply chain, software ecosystem, you know, is kind of not safe to globalize in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. So the company's called Elbit. I mean, for all we know, it's a perfectly fine and suitable battle management system, right? Why not buy that from Israel? But yeah, look, this is a developing story. It's got traction at very high political levels, so that one will be developing over time. Now, this is an interesting story. Zerodium is talking about, like, they're trying to solicit bugs for Pigeon, the IM client, and they're going to pay up to $100,000, which surprised me because I would have thought that bugs in Pigeon were not that difficult to come by. But then the guy who, like, develops Pigeon is like, you know, I got 25 grand in grant money for the last, you know, however long to work on Pigeon, and you're offering 100K. Like, everything is broken, FML, basically. And, you know, yeah, this is something Katie Masouris has talked about, which is perverse incentives when it comes to bug hunting. For the most part, I actually disagree with Katie on that. I don't think it's a huge problem, but this is an absolutely perfect example of her concerns and what she's talking about. So maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
Yeah, I saw the guy's tweet go past, and really, you do got a feel for the dude, you know, like thinking how hard. I mean, you know, a lot of open source developers really do, you know, pour their heart and soul into those projects. They are labors of love. And then to have someone turn around and say, hey, we'll pay $100,000, you know, to buy mistakes in your product or in the thing that you've developed there, that's got to be a hard day, you know, reading that after you've, you know, probably spent your regular work day at your actual job, and then you got to come home and work on your hobby project. So yeah, that's a tough one to swallow. And on the other hand, I'm also surprised they're willing to pay $100,000 for a Pigeon bug. I mean, maybe no one's looked at Pigeon in the last few years because, you know, there were so many bugs, and, you know, 10 years ago in that piece of software, you know, maybe not enough people use it anymore. But clearly Zerodium has a market, otherwise they, you know, Tukey wouldn't be putting his money up if he didn't have a way to sell it.
Staying on the topic of, like, you know, money for bugs, Caesar has actually done a deal with BugCrowd to handle bug reporting for civilian government agencies. This is a great thing, you know? And yeah, you know, they've been working towards this for a while, but it's good to see it moving along.
Yeah, I mean, certainly bringing in, you know, an organization with a bunch of experience running these programs, you know, like BugCrowd is really useful. Getting a bug bounty program, the mechanics of it right, you know, is a thing that does require some experience. And obviously we've seen, you know, Department of Defense in the US, you know, have bug bounty programs in the past. But yeah, Caesar, you know, covers a lot of jurisdiction, has a lot of territory, and being able to provide, you know, a centralized place to do that makes a lot of sense for US government. And, you know, anything that makes it safe and easy to report bugs that people inevitably find in government stuff, you know, is good for everybody.
Yeah, they've launched a platform with BugCrowd and another company called Endia. I'm not sure if they actually, I don't think they're at the bounty phase yet. It's more like VDP, but still a good move. What else have we got now? Russians fishing, doing spear phishing against Ukraine. I mean, you know, wow. Why didn't we lead with that? Such a man bites dog story. No surprise here, I guess.
Yeah, this was, we saw reports of a campaign in which Russians were pretending to be the police from Kyiv and saying, you haven't paid your taxes, please download this
PDF.exe. Yeah.
So really bring in their A game to Ukraine there.
It's total lazy mode stuff, isn't it, right? But they wouldn't do it if it didn't work. And you just sort of, yeah.
Well, yeah, which,
rub your temples. We got a write-up here, another one from Catalin. That last one was from Catalin Kimpanu as well. Looks like the, you know, presidential website in Myanmar has a habit of dropping malware on visitors.
It's not exactly A game exactly, but I do admire the audacity of this, which is that whether it's the Chinese, whether it's the Myanmar government themselves, I don't really know. Although some of the technical indicators do point to China. What they did was they trojaned like the font download for like the national font, right? Because obviously the script in Myanmar is not a thing that everybody's operating system is going to have installed. So they have these font downloads available on the president's website, and they backdoored the installer for that, which, I mean,
I mean, it's lazy mode, but again,
it is. It
you're
going to
get
mode,
shells
but,
that way.
But dang, yeah. I mean, this would work so well. This has been identified, obviously, but it's actually still live, according to reporting on the site. So maybe don't go install fonts from Myanmar today.
Hilarious story here from Brian Krebs. and I mean, one of the things I love about some of Brian's reports is he's it's like they read like a diary entry, just if the funniest thing happened to me today, you know? Like, and it's just one of them.
Yeah, speaking of government sites offering stuff for you to download, if you would like to communicate with the Russian FSB and send them some important information, or in Brian's case, ask them for comment about a story, turns out you have to do so communicating using a specific Russian cipher that other operating systems don't necessarily have. And so you go to the FSB's website and they provide like an EXE for you to run, which will set up like a temporary VPN back up to the FSB using the approved Russian cipher so that you can then visit the encrypted bit of the website. So like the normal website's in HTTP and you have to download this EXE in the clear from their website, and then
so far so good.
Which is detected by a whole bunch of AV as plausibly malware. And it's funny because that appears to be a heuristic detection for the specific Russian cipher. And so, yeah, you have to install this one-time VPN client and then as an EXE, and then you can connect to them. And the funny thing is that Brian is asking them for comment about this exact VPN software being detected as malware. It's a bit circular.
Just a funny one there. What else have we got? Oh, yeah, FireEye, a bit of business news. FireEye and Mandiant are splitting again. They were brought together. It didn't last. They're getting divorced.
Yes. FireEye's product business, all of their endpoint detection stuff and other, other bits of security software being split off into a separate products division. That's been bought by
Symphony Technology Group.
So, yeah, the rest of FireEye's incident response business, the traditional Mandiant side, is going to, I guess, continue as and re-become Mandiant.
Well, we never really stopped calling them Mandiant.
Well, no, we didn't, right? So, and it's certainly not helped by, Chief Executive Officer Kevin Mandia of FireEye Mandiant. Of course we're going to call it Mandiant.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny though, right? Because that was our little sign of protest. That was what we did. So congratulations to all you Mandiant people for not being wedded to a product company anymore. I'm sure that'll be welcome news for some, not for others. And best of luck also to the people on the products side of the business. Now, look, we spoke a few weeks ago about how GitHub was going to mull over how it was going to treat exploits on its platform and try to come up with some policy. Looks like they've come up with some ideas here and they don't look insane, which is, I mean, and it's funny, the reason they don't look insane is because they're going to keep it flexible and case by case and just kind of use some common sense, which I wish more companies would do.
Yeah, that does seem like the right outcome here, and I'm also glad to see a common sense approach here. So kind of where they've arrived at is it's fine to host security research and exploits and, other kind of security sensitive stuff on GitHub, develop it there, interact with the community there. They reserve the right to take stuff down if it's being used in like active campaigns, if you're serving, kind of second stages out of there, or if you're, actively pushing, live campaigns out of GitHub infrastructure, they absolutely reserve the right to pull it down. And then they've come up with a bunch of ideas about how people can, kind of go through that process, if their stuff is taken down, what the process for challenging that is. Building hopefully a thing that, represents the fact that this is dual use software, right? It can, research and public disclosure and public discussion is really useful, but it can also be used in really bad ways.
Well, I think, what they've done is they've basically made their previous actions kind of official. They've wrapped a policy around it, which is, saying if there's an exploit being hosted here that everyone's downloading and using to hose the internet, we're going to pull it down. And that, previously that was just something they did because they thought it was the right thing to do. And now that's policy, right? So that's good. I think we spoke about it last week or the week before, that vCenter bug with the CVSS score, bug with the CVSS of 9.8. That one apparently is now being exploited in the wild, according to this piece by Dan Gooden. But come on, every time you see anything with a CVSS that high, it's gonna be exploited in the wild, quick.
Yes, and especially when in the case of this where the consequence is so high, right? I mean, busting into VMware buys you a whole bunch of stuff. So we've seen proof of concept and like working weaponized exploit code kicking around the internet. There's certainly a bunch of scanning. People are looking for it on the outside. I think we saw Gossy the dog, Kevin Beaumont, saying that one of his honeypots got shelled via it pretty soon. So, yeah, there's definitely active people using it. And you know, the internal use case, like the post-intrusion, you know, once you've got a fish or you've got an initial foothold and you're inside and you want to do like ransomware, for example, this is, it's absolutely going to be used. So if you have VMware infrastructure, you really, really, really need to patch it.
I did an interview with Andrew Morris of Greynoise, which is running in a few weeks when we're back from our break. And he said like this one was like, because they operate sensors, right? And they try to deprioritize SIEM alerts. Like that's their whole thing. They pick up background noise and mass scanning and stuff. But they're trying to look for stuff like this as well. So they can tell their customers, hey, that thing is being, you know, used right now. So you can tell your bosses that we need to act and reboot that sensitive box right now. That's kind of the thinking there. But they saw this one going out like pretty much instantly, you know. Yeah. It was like headline and then every single sensor they had kind of lit up, is what you're going to expect. What do we got? Election Guard. This is Microsoft's SDK for secure voting machines. Looks like Election Guard is finally getting some love from the voting machine industry, Adam.
Yes, Hart and DeCivic, which is one of the big US manufacturers of voting equipment and software, they've entered a partnership with Microsoft to kind of build out their voting machines to be able to use the Election Guard kind of techniques. They're the smallest of the three, and we still haven't really seen them, you know, get to the point where they've got, you know, actual fielded trials. But clearly, you know, given the focus on the integrity of electronic voting, you know, it's important that this makes some headway. And Microsoft's, you know, suggestions with Election Guard really did look like, you know, a pretty sensible way to approach it. Hopefully this will lead the way. We'll see some successful trials and onwards from there.
Yep. And we're going to close out this week's show with a bit of a bug postmortem from Akamai, which actually looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, so Akamai have written up a bug that they encountered with their enterprise application access proxy. So they provide a mechanism where you could use Akamai's network to provide front-end access to your corporate app. So if you want to build like a zero trust style system with, you know, single sign-on using Akamai's global network, then you could do it with authentication integration.
It's like an identity-aware proxy sort of thing, right?
Yes, exactly. Front-end authenticating proxy so that you can do this sort of zero trust stuff and authenticate all your individual apps. Makes a lot of sense. They had a bug where you could kind of authenticate as another user, and they've written up the kind of root cause analysis of that, which funnily enough turned out to be like a SAML signing issue. I don't know if you remember from KiwiCon 2 or 3, maybe Peter Gutman did a talk in which he basically said that XML signing is essentially impossible because of the canonicalization issues with how you represent XML.
I actually do remember that talk. And funnily enough, I'm sitting here in my KiwiCon 2 hoodie. So that was, what, 2008? But anyway, yes, I do remember that talk.
Yeah, so this is a classic example of essentially that, right? There was a way to confuse the signing process and to slip other XML content into a message that was signed originally, but now you can, as an attacker, modify the content. So, yeah, great example of the complexities we bought ourselves, you know, with XML and crypto, and then trying to build a world on top of it.
Yeah, it's funny because that the reason I remember that talk is because it was pretty convincing, right? Well, like, it's not often you see a talk like about something so fundamental that you're like, yeah, okay, this is never really going to be 100%, you know?
Yes, and you know, I'm kind of glad that XML has fallen out of favor a bit, because this is certainly one of the, you know, how you canonicalize it, how you sign it, you know, even how you parse it correctly is still really, you know, that's a thing we're struggling with this many years later. Yeah. This, you know, bug in SAML parsing in Akamai's product, great example of that.
Well, and hat tip to them for actually doing a decent write-up on it.
Yes. Yeah. It's certainly really valuable to see an organization kind of talk about exactly what happened and draw the right conclusions from it. And you know, sets a good example for everybody else.
Well, Adam, that's actually it for the week's news, and what a week to go out on. That was fantastic. I am, of course, having 2 weeks off so that I can sleep during the day. That's probably what I'll be doing for 2 weeks. I'll just sleep and sleep and sleep.
sounds pretty good.
I've actually spent 6 of the last 8 weeks sick with colds that my daughter keeps bringing home from daycare because we've been living normal lives, relatively normal lives in Australia and New Zealand. It means we've still been getting colds, right? Because we're not all stuck at home trying to avoid the very bad cold. Some time off to rest and recuperate is the plan. And I guess I'll be chatting to you in 3 weeks from now.
Yes, and in 3 weeks, we'll hear a lot, a bit more story about this whole Anom thing and whatever other bad stuff happens whilst you're on holiday.
Can't so, you wait. Know,
prepare yourself, internet. Pat's going on holiday. You all know what that means.
That was Adam Boileau of CyberCX there with a look at the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Michael Yamnitsky from Datadog. They've recently branched out into offering a cloud security posture management tool. Now, these types of tools are designed to examine your cloud infrastructure to look for a whole bunch of issues, really. So the useful tools will, you know, maybe just tell you about the top five things you may have messed up instead of generating 6 million alerts. It might tell you, hey, TLS isn't enabled on this Elastic Load Balancer, or this Kubernetes cluster is misconfigured, or how about a golden oldie? This S3 bucket is wide open. That sort of stuff. So Michael thinks CSPM tools are set to become a pretty standard buy among organizations that are cloud heavy. So Michael joined me for this interview to talk through all of that, and here's what he had to say.
So first of all, our product is currently in beta. However, we do have a large enough sample size that we can look and see what are the types of configuration errors that people are doing. First of all, I would say Docker and Kubernetes are both one place where there's so many errors and so many issues. Things like if you have an overly permissive Kubernetes security policy, for example. Second thing we see is people using the default ports for different cloud resources way too much. Fourth example, people use the default port for RDS too much. We find that over half of customers have this issue, and we can even see that the posture score, so the percentage of the RDS instances with this issue, is something like 90%. So it's very high.
What you say about the container stuff is interesting, because I've interviewed other people before for whom that's a bit of a specialty, and they just say people shouldn't run their own Kubernetes instances. They should go to a sort of specialist hosting provider. You seem to be saying that that sounds like decent advice given the number of people who managed to misconfigure it.
Yes. So we see things both ways, right? Like if you are using EKS, you can still configure several parts of that service. So it really depends on, like, there are still things you can change whether you're using a managed service or not.
Now, we've spoken thus far about sort of container-related stuff, but I'd imagine that you are also looking at things like AWS, GCP, and Azure. What are the sort of misconfigurations that are most common there, right? Because I imagine there are a lot of them.
Sure. So I spoke about the examples with RDS. Just sticking within the world of Amazon, some of the others are... We do see a lot of misconfigures within Elastic load balancers. So for example, people forget to turn on logging, they forget to update to the latest security policies. And yeah, so there's that. We do see sometimes that folks forget to turn on encryption for storage buckets. That's a bad one as well.
So where did you start with this stuff? Like, what was the number one use case that you had in mind when you started pulling this together?
So the biggest use case we see is that there's really this huge risk of having misconfigurations within your cloud environment. That could happen anywhere. It could be one small thing that was misconfigured, one resource in one account. That could be the thing that causes the breach. And so what we wanted to do was create a way to surface all of these, right? So that's the core basis of cloud security posture management. But where we're going with the product is being able to sort of parse through this whole sea of all of these different alerts and all of these things to tell software developers what are the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 most important things that they have to do that will help prevent a potential breach. And that's really the core of the problem today, because there is a lot of cloud security products out there that can report and they can detect on configuration issues. But these things can generate thousands and thousands of individual alerts. You can't have developers fix all of these things. They just don't have the time to do that. And so that was really the crux of us wanting to build this product, is to address this problem of how do you sift through thousands and thousands of individual code alerts.
Yeah, and how do you go through that many configs as well? Because there's so much sprawl in cloud-related stuff, right? You basically need automation to be able to surface some of these problems. I mean, is that part of the root of the problem here, is just the complexity that we deal with these environments?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think it just comes down to what the core problem is, right? There are so many developers at these companies that have admin access to these cloud accounts. And the number of developers is growing through the roof. And then you have all these cloud resources, and that is growing as well, because Azure, GCP, AWS, they release several dozens every single year. And you have companies going to containers and to Kubernetes, which just completely multiplies the amount of cloud resources out there. So if you take those two factors, and there's just so many potential things that can be misconfigured. And so that really creates a big data problem.
Yeah. So when you're talking about surfacing, say, the top five things, right, that a customer might be instructed to deal with as a result of using your tooling, you know, what's a typical like top three that this tool might spit out? Like, I'm sure you can think of a case study where it's like, well, you know, it told a customer to fix XYZ. What do those things typically look like?
I mean, look, the one very simple thing is, yeah, you want to surface if there's any type of a potential data breach. And so if there is an encryption turned off on an S3 bucket, if you have read-write access to the bucket, these are the type of very obvious things that you want to show right away. The real question is, What about that second tier of things that could be wrong, right? Like, what about things like whether a default port is being used? Is that important or not? That depends on what else is talking to that particular resource. What is the importance of this particular resource in terms of its business value, and a host of other factors that you need to think about to say, okay, of these sort of medium severity configuration problems, which ones should I focus on?
Now, I'm curious too, pricing isn't something we normally talk about on the show when we talk to vendors, but Datadog's a company that does stuff at scale, right? So, I mean, is this going to be some enterprise, you know, gold tier sort of expensive thing, or is this going to be like a very cheap, accessible service that's available to small business? Like, how are you actually targeting this thing, like in terms of pricing? Is this something for everyone, or is this something for enterprise?
Yeah, so look, this is a product for all Datadog customers. And the way that we think about pricing is we want to make it very simple, very transparent, as well as really aligned to value and think about the pricing in a way that would not discourage usage. So we won't charge you based on how many rules we check against your infrastructure. We have some way to figure out how big is your environment, and we use that to charge you, but we don't charge you for certain types of rule sets or certain types of regulatory frameworks that we might align to.
Now, do you think this is a space that's going to be more competitive in the future? Do you think are there more vendors going into this sort of thing?
In general, cloud security posture management is one of the biggest and fastest growing parts of the cybersecurity market. We have seen several startups, as well as pretty much every large security vendor that is active in cloud security has a CSPM.
Do you think this is going to be like a standard buy for everyone eventually? Because it sounds like the sort of thing that's just sensible for, you know, it's a sensible thing for people to use.
Yes, absolutely. I think if you are running any type of cloud environment, you need a CSPM. Like I said, I see sort of a phase one and phase two in the market, where phase one was just figure out how to detect all of the problems in your cloud environment. The phase two, which is much harder, is how do you help software developers that are responsible for these services to be the ones to fix these problems? Because at the end of the day, they own the underlying services and they are the ones who are best fit to address these misconfigurations.
It's been really interesting for me over the last 5 years to see this emergence of an entire new class of security products targeted towards developers. Like, it's probably the area that I have the least knowledge of, but it's fantastic that, you know, because we've been saying for 10 years that it'd be great if developers got interested in security, and that's actually happened now. So it's all wonderful stuff. Michael Yamnitsky, thank you so much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about some of Datadog's tooling. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Patrick.
That was Michael Yamnitsky there from Datadog, and I've linked through to some information on their public beta in this week's show notes, so you can check out their approach in a little more detail if that is something you are interested in. And that is it for this week's show. I will be dropping a soapbox edition of the show in a couple of days, featuring Yubico's Chief Solutions Officer, Jared Chong. But then, yeah, nothing from us for a couple of weeks. So I hope you all have a good one and stay safe. And until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.